My name's Tad Homer-Dixon, and I'm the director of the Waterloo Institute for Complexity and Innovation, and I'm absolutely delighted to see you all here today. I think we have a really remarkable event, and it's going to be terrifically interesting. I can say that I'm certainly looking forward to it, to talk about the nature of technology, and in particular to have a conversation with W. Brian Arthur, who's standing on the side here, about what technology is and how it changes, how it evolves over time. And we have, I think, a remarkable lineup of people to consider this issue today. The Waterloo community is really amazingly well endowed with people who think about innovation. And in particular, we have Lee Smolin from the Perimeter Institute and Francis Wesley of Social Innovation Generation to comment on W. Brian Arthur's ideas. I'm afraid I'm just going to shorten this to Brian Arthur, or maybe even Brian by the end of the event. And then engage in a conversation, and we hope to involve you in that conversation later on in the event. The focus of our conversation is going to be this remarkable book, The Nature of Technology, which came out last year and has just been published in paperback. It's for sale just outside. I found out over lunch today that Brian had worked on this book for 13 years. It's remarkable in its accessibility, among other things. I'm a writer by profession, at least it's one of my hats, and I admire anyone who can take very difficult and subtle ideas and make them so lucid as they are in this book. It's an absolutely beautiful piece of work with a very powerful argument that because of its clarity might seem almost too simple. It sort of slides by and then you realize as you read and reread the passages through this book just how deeply nuanced the argument is. Well, I think we should get going. I'm not a big fan of long and windy introductions, so I'm going to read a very brief bio for each of our folks today. And then Brian will speak for about 20 to 30 minutes. And then Lee and Francis and I and Brian will all sit here. Francis has a few remarks to make, Lee a few remarks, and then we'll just begin a conversation and see where it goes. And at some point, I'll ask for your comments and questions. So of the three people we have today, W. Brian Arthur is an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute and a visiting researcher at PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center. Formerly, he was Morrison Professor of Economics and Population Studies at Stanford University. One of the pioneers of complexity theory, he is the recipient of the International Schumpeter Prize in Economics and the inaugural Lagrange Prize in Complexity Science. Now, I am dramatically abbreviating the bios of our guests here today. I could go on and on. For the case of Lee Smolin, he's a founding member and research physicist here at the Perimeter Institute. He has held faculty positions at Yale, Syracuse, and Penn State universities, where he helped to found the Center for Gravitational Physics and Geometry. Dr. Smolin has made major contributions to the field of quantum gravity. He has also a strong interest in philosophy, and his three books, Life of the Cosmos, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, and The Trouble with Physics, are in part philosophical explorations of issues raised by contemporary physics. And Francis Wesley is the J.W. McConnell Chair in Social Innovation at the University of Waterloo, where she heads up Social Innovation Generation, which we fondly know as SIG, a national initiative designed to build capacity for social innovation in Canada. Before joining the University of Waterloo in 2007, she was director of the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research, writing, and teaching centers on social innovation and complex problem domains, with particular emphasis on leadership and managing strategic change. Now, again, this book is deceptively simple, but there is a point at the beginning where Brian introduces the fundamental task that we face, and he points out that despite all of the thinking and work on the subject of technology that's taken place over centuries and centuries, that there really isn't a very well-developed theory of technological change. He says technology is what separates us from the Middle Ages. Indeed, it is what separates us from the way we lived 50,000 or more years ago. More than anything else, technology creates our world. It creates our wealth, our economy, our very way of being. What, then, is this thing of such importance? What is technology in its nature, in its deepest essence? Where does it come from? And how does it evolve? And those are some of the questions we're going to be considering today. Thank you, and Brian.
Thank you, and I must say I'm delighted to be here. I've been invited the last two or three years to visit the Perimeter Institute from Lee, and of course, Wiki and CG as well, so somehow I feel I'm hitting all three at once, and I'm really thrilled to be here. It's something that's been in my mind the last two or three years is to come up here, because there's such a concentration of interest here in complexity issues, and science, of course, as well. I was thinking at the start that I would be giving a one-hour talk, and then after an email or two, it became clear it was going to be a 10-minute talk. And then after another set of morphings, it's a 30-minute talk. And in each case, I had an idea in my mind as to what the appropriate talk would be. And in the end, I decided I'd just have a talk ready that could be compressed or expanded indefinitely in either direction. So just in case anything went wrong this morning, I came up with a 1-second version, or maybe a 2-second talk, which is three words: technology is organic. And that's really the theme of what I want to talk about here. The book is on technology. My background is supposedly in economics, and my expertise was actually human fertility in the third world, if you can believe that. That's a lot of what I taught. And people ask me, especially in Santa Fe, what are you doing sort of grubbing around in this field of technology? But somehow I got absolutely fascinated by it. I do have one or two degrees in engineering earlier, and that had kind of whetted my appetite. And what I started to do in the late 90s was to somehow get fascinated by technology. And I began to read more and more and more about not technology in general or academic takes on technology, but individual technologies, how they'd come into being, who had initiated them, how they were invented, if there were physical devices. Much of that led me off into reading about physics and science, naturally. And the whole thing became a quest. I was curious to see if I could see any pattern about technology. And when I say I spent 13 years doing this, everybody's seems a bit shocked. Oh, my God, 13 years. One response I can give is that I'm a slow learner. The other response is that actually most of the 13 years, about 10 years, is what anthropologists would call field work, looking at technologies. I do remember interviewing, for example, Joseph Sutter, who was the director of the project at Boeing that brought the Boeing 747 into existence, and asking him and interviewing him, asking a lot of questions. So it was kind of a quest on my part to make sense of technology, what could be said about it, was there anything could be said about it. Then I condensed all that I had thought into a framework and wrote the book. And the book is it's out there. It came out in Italian this weekend. It's gone into 7 languages so far, and most of those I won't be able to read after all, but so I have to trust that that it's okay. Anyway, I'm thrilled and delighted. I want to start by saying, picking up on something Tad said, that there is a huge amount known about individual technologies out there. So I'm not saying that, you know, I stumbled in this area, there's nothing known about it. There's an enormous amount known. And when I started to look at this, I went down into the basement of Green Library in Stanford, the stacks, and actually started to look at the engineering books down there. There's huge numbers of books, as you can well imagine, on individual technologies, and stretching back over 100, 200 years. But as I looked, and this was in the early days of the project, what I couldn't find was principles of technology. And I began to realize that the field was somewhere, and possibly I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it reminded me of where biology, or what would have been called natural science, was somewhere around 1798 or 1800, when people like Georges Cuvier were working. He was an anatomist, a natural historian, I suppose, in Paris. I'm sure you've heard the name Cuvier. Huge amounts were known about individual species. Enormous amounts were known about the anatomies of those species. Lots was known about comparative anatomy. And yet there were very few overall principles to tie all these individual species together. There was certainly, although there was a theory of evolution in the air, there were no particular mechanisms by which everybody agreed evolution could work. That was to come 59 years later or so. People were not sure or had no particular idea where individual species had come from. You could say they came from God. So there were, what was missing in the field of natural history, what we call biology, were principles. Of course, that is no longer the case in biology. Biology is extremely well researched and is still moving forward. But what I found to my amazement was that there wasn't much in the way of principles when you start to look at technology. And if you looked at individual technologies as species, it wasn't clear how they were related at all. A lot of what I learned, or attitudes I learned about looking at technology, came from my training in economics. And I have to tell you, I was trained well as an economist, which I'm not sure is a good idea. I was trained well in a sort of 19th century view of what the economy was like. This was at Berkeley. And we were told that technologies were basically, by the way, economists are interested in technology because that's where the economy comes from. So they had a keen interest. But for most of what they were interested in, technologies were stand-alone things. So we would talk about the Bessemer process for producing steel, and then that was replaced by the Thomas process. 15 years later, another stand-alone technology. Or we had the McCormick Reaper, or in due course we got hybrid corn and so on. In each case, the economy would sort of leap forward, and these technologies would be adopted. And there were even attempts at a theory of evolution for technology. That's been around a long time. But it was mostly very Darwinian, that technologies would vary somehow because different designers had different ideas. And the best of those ideas would lead to further progress. And eventually, maybe technologies would speciate off the way Darwin talked about. But nobody was very sure if there was a theory of evolution for technology. Although we all hoped somebody would find one, there was completely lacking any theory of invention of technology. Invention was never talked about. It was one of these things kind of was glossed over. We didn't have the Bessemer process. Bessemer came along, then we had the Bessemer process. What happened in between was never quite talked about in economics. And this is still largely the state of the field, or it was when I started to look at this 10 years or more ago. Now, I'm not saying there isn't tons known about innovation, and I notice that virtually all institutions in Waterloo have innovation at the end of their name. I'm surprised it's not the Perimeter Institute for Innovation, but, you know, I'm just putting the idea out there if you want to get more funding. So I'm not saying there aren't ideas out there, but there wasn't a coherent set of principles, and this is kind of what became for me a quest for the white whale. And you can take a look at my book and decide whether or not I got there. What I'd like to do in just a few minutes, actually 20 or 25 minutes, is pick up a couple of themes out of the book. I don't like it much when people say, you know, you have 15 minutes to talk about your book, because I'm not objecting here, but the book is a kind of mosaic, and you lay in each particular stone, and if you look at the individual pieces, they don't make any sense whatever. But when you stand back and look at the overall pattern, you begin to see a picture emerge. So it's a little bit hard for me to take the picture out without talking about those individual pieces. What I decided to do is, rather than cover all the ideas in the book, I would just take out two ideas or two themes, and that is the subtitle of the book, What Technology Is, and the second one's How It Evolves. So I want to cover those pretty rapidly, and then we have discussion here and more conversation about this. So I want to start off by saying that I define a technology, an individual technology, as a means to a human purpose. And that means could be, say, an algorithm, or it could be a device, wavelength division multiplexer, or it could be quite simple, it could be a rivet, it could be some device, it certainly could be something sociological, some particular means to a purpose, say like central banking or maybe some particular institution. So it's a pretty wide definition. And that means to a purpose, as I started to look at individual technologies and think more about devices, such as, say, radio receivers, or pick your favorite device. It could be something from physics. It could be anything in engineering. But if you look at any particular device, you begin to see it's made up or constructed or put together from individual parts. And in that sense, for me, for some reason, economists and social scientists were not particularly interested in opening up technologies and looking inside them to see if they had anything in common. A few have done so as historians, and I think I learned most from what they had written. But when you start to take an individual technology, let me just mention, say, the jet engine, which keeps recurring through the book. Engineers would call it the gas turbine aircraft power plant, but let's call it the jet engine. When you start to look at anything like that, you see it has individual components or modules. And then if you look in more detail, those assemblies or modules themselves have sub-assemblies and sub-modules. It's a bit like any organism. If you take, say, anything, could be a giraffe or something, you look in, open it up, look inside it, you will see organs, the heart, liver, pancreas, and so on. It's not very good analogy, but you know, if you start to look at those organs themselves, you might see some parts of those chambers in the heart or whatever it would be. If you look at sub-parts of that, you might see individual cells. subparts of that, you'll see organelles within the cells, and beneath that you might get down to the level of structures for transporting molecules, the core of the nucleus, DNA, and the proteins that work on DNA. So individual organisms are structures that have organs, subparts, sub-subparts, and the same goes for technology. And that's all very well, but you say, well, if you take, say, a laser printer, which has subparts and sub-subparts, or another example I was looking at was the F-35C aircraft, which is the Joint Strike Fighter. Military examples were great. You see that it's a fighter aircraft. It has subparts, those of sub-subparts, and so on. You say, well, that military fighter aircraft doesn't resemble much a laser printer, nor does that resemble much, say, a computer program that's written out. So how could those have much the same structure? What I started to realize, and this is really the principle at the heart of the book, is that if you take an individual technology, let me mention again the jet engine. So just to refresh your, if you studied thermodynamics as an undergraduate, remember that air comes in to a jet engine at whatever velocity the aircraft is traveling at. There's a compressor, and the compressor pumps the air up to a much higher pressure, several factors of magnitude. Then the highly compressed air is mixed with fuel. The mixture is ignited in combustion chambers, and it's passed through turbines. The turbines do the work of running the compressor largely, and then the hot air and the energy in that airflow is passed out through an exhaust nozzle at high velocity. And you could say it's either Newton's second or third law at work. You could say at high velocity there's an equal the force of the air being blasted back at high velocity, like letting go of blowing up a balloon and letting go of it, there's an equal and opposite forward force. Or you can say that what you're doing is taking in air and increasing its velocity backwards, and then there's an equal and opposite forward force. Whichever you like way to look at it, what I want you to notice is that there are subparts or organs within the technology. But then there's organs within those organs. The compressor isn't just a single unit. These days it consists maybe of 20 or 30 stages, and those themselves consist of turbine blades, and those also have controllers and guide vanes and so on. So technology, an individual technology, is constructed from subparts that have subparts that have subparts, all talking to each other, interconnected, and so on. The key thing I began to realize was that each of those subparts of a technology, each subassembly, itself is a means. The compressor in a jet engine is a means to pump up the pressure of the air. So it qualifies as a technology as well. And if you like, if you take any sub-assembly, you will find it also is a means to a purpose. So I began to realize as I was looking at all these individual technologies that a technology consists of modules that themselves are technologies, that consist of sub-modules that themselves are sub-technologies, that consist of sub-sub-modules and so on, that themselves are technologies. In other words, a single technology has a recursive structure. And this is true for the original idea that lay behind this was that I was learning years and years ago, 1992, to program in C. C is now of historical interest, the computer program C, or the computer language C. But I began to realize that the structure of a C program and the structure of a jet engine were logically identical. A C program, as you remember, and this is true in other programming languages that are more up to date, consists of a main program that calls sub-programs, it sometimes calls sub-sub-programs, maybe 3, 4, 5 levels down, all interacting, all conversing, all talking to each other. So I began to see that a technology, a single technology, such as a jet engine, isn't so much a stand-alone device. It's actually something organic that's constructed out of different layers and levels of sub-technologies, almost fractal-like, when, if you say we're talking poetically or loosely about fractals here, and we're talking about finite depth of fractals here. Technologies consist of sub-technologies, consist of sub-sub-technologies, all conversing among different levels, triggering each other, shutting each other off, reconfiguring on the fly, and so on. And that started to look a lot more organic to me than the standard thing saying a technology is just a standalone device, and then it's replaced by a better version of a standalone device, and so on. What I want you to keep in mind is that a single technology, think of early computers, say the ENIAC or the EDVAC, this is going back to the 1940s. Any device like a computer is very much an organic, fluid, dynamic structure. And innovation happens routinely, or I would call it development happens, in a technology by sliding out some of the submodules. It's like sliding them out, out of a computer and substituting better modules, or maybe adding on modules for more complication, but to achieve higher performance. And so the picture I would like to paint of a technology is not at all a fixed thing, but something that's organic. The internal parts are constantly changing. Sometimes the whole field that that technology belongs to is changing, and new modules come along and they're slid in. Performance greatly improves. And then maybe somewhere down the line, somebody finds a completely different principle to achieve the same purpose. And a different configuration of technologies takes over. Like the air piston engine, which was greatly elaborated in various pieces and parts, got replaced by the jet engine. The jet engine in its turn may be replaced. Who knows? The other principle I want to mention is that all technologies, whether they're submodules or the whole technology, are based upon at least one phenomenon. If these are physical devices, they're typically based on physical phenomena. If they're algorithms, they may be based upon logical or mathematical effects or phenomena, whatever you want to call those. It's a bit like tree ring dating. Tree ring dating, as you know, dendrochronology is a method. If you have a lintel or something and you find it's maybe, roughly speaking, 2,000 years old, and you dig this thing out, you can actually analyze, as you know, the variation in the tree rings, and then you can match that against known variations, given that the tree rings vary with the weather, and then therefore you can date the piece of wood you're looking at. But notice that's based upon a particular set of phenomena, that there's differential growth in trees depending on upon the seasons and the weather that tree has been through. Well, so this gives a different version of a technology. What I'm saying is that when you open up any individual technology, be it a computer program or an application, or a physical piece of technology, or a method such as dendrochronology, you notice that it is made up of subparts or subprocesses or submethods that are made up of sub-submethods in a recursive fashion. And that allows us to go in a different direction, and this is what I want to point out. Oh, by the way, then, to answer philosophically the question that I pose in the subtitle to the book, what is technology, what it is and how it evolves, my answer is that a technology is a phenomenon programmed or orchestrated to fulfill some purpose. But given that it's not just a single phenomenon, if you look at a jet engine or even a computer application or any particular method, you will see that each of the sub-assemblies are using their own phenomena and that other sub-subparts are there to help refine the phenomenon, maybe give it energy or whatever it needs, help control it. So a technology is basically an orchestration of phenomena to some purpose. And in the book, I take the jet engine again, and I mention 20 or 30 different phenomena that are carefully orchestrated, all to work in concert together. 2 days ago, I came here from Frankfurt to Toronto, and you're sitting, say, over Greenland or northern Canada, basically relying on 2 jet engines or 4. You're relying on those phenomena working all the time, or being perfectly orchestrated all the time, shutting each other in and reconfiguring, doing everything exactly as needed. And if something goes wrong with the orchestra of these phenomena, you are in trouble in the aircraft. I want to mention a different direction, and that is that I've been saying that technologies are constructed. They're put together from pieces or parts, like Lego blocks, that themselves are technologies that already exist. And this gives us an important clue about where novel technologies come from, even radically novel ones, such as, say, radar in the 1930s. Novel technologies are put together as combinations of what already exists. So when I started to look at, say, radar, and I studied that in a lot of detail, and maybe 20 or so other technologies in great detail, you begin to see that those are put together from individual things that already exist, but for very different purposes. So what did exist in the base phenomenon of radar, of course, is that you send out some high-energy electromagnetic signal. It goes out, it's somewhat distorted, or if you prefer, echoes off something metal, and you can measure the time to receive the echo. All the parts to do that existed before radar was fully developed. Certain parts had to be refined, such as getting proper very high frequency oscillators that had enough power to send out such signals that could go out for 10 or 20 miles and come back. So I began to realize that radically novel technologies were put together or constructed from what already exists. When I looked at that, I discovered I wasn't the first person to think about that. In fact, that idea is quite old. It certainly goes back to Schumpeter, who was writing 100 years ago, 1911, 1912. Schumpeter said all novel things in the economy are combinations of what already exists. I discovered the idea was even older. I traced it back to the 1880s and doubtless somebody who's a rail scholar will trace it back to 1564 or something like that. But so the idea is not particularly new. But then there's a second idea, and that is that if novel technologies, including inventions, by the way, when I say things are combinations, I don't mean that engineers or physicists sit down and say, I will now combine the following parts. It's more that they have a purpose in mind and possibly even a set of phenomena that they're using. Think in terms of Los Alamos, nuclear fission, chain reactions, and so on, or the nuclear chain reaction that Szilard and others thought about in the late 30s. And the idea is, how do we make that real? How do we bring that into physical reality? And when you start to bring it into physical reality, you notice you're using combinations of centrifuges, thermal diffusion devices, etc., etc., combinations of technologies that already exist. But to say that engineers or physicists sit down and say we're going to have a new combination is a bit like saying that when you speak English, you're going to have a new combination. Suppose I give you the task of giving me a logical argument for some legal case you're arguing, and say, give me a legal brief, which would be a concatenation or a combination of arguments put together possibly from past cases, from the facts, from other areas. You're not aware that you're putting together a combination. You're really expressing something quite complicated. But in the end, it's put together from what already exists, what you know about. When you start to look at that, you begin to then see that all technologies in existence act as a kind of a large collection of objects that stand ready for some of their pieces to be combined to make new technologies. And this is where I discovered, again, I wasn't the first person to think about that. There's a sociologist called William Fielding Ogburn. I'm not sure you can read that from the back, so I'll just say. In 1922, he wrote a book, Social Change. The book is still a classic. Ogburn, by the way, was interested in why what were then called primitive societies weren't developing, weren't coming up with new inventions, but Western societies were, and what was the explanation? He didn't believe you could say, well, these people are not as smart as we are, or some other thing like that. It was much more that, I'll give you his argument. It would seem that the larger the equipment of material culture, the greater the number of inventions. The more there is to invent with, the greater will be the number of inventions. The streetcar, going down to the end here, the streetcar could not have been invented from the material culture existing at the last glacial period. In other words, the whole collection of technologies we have stands ready as possible components to invent or put together or combine for further technologies. And I think that Ogburn could have easily made this into a theory of evolution for technology, which is what I want to do in the last few minutes here. But for some reason, he didn't follow this up. The discovery of the power of steam and the mechanical technology existing at the time made possible a large number of inventions. So the more components you have, the more technologies you have, the more you have to invent with. And that gives a view that technology, now I'm thinking of the whole collective of technology, the vast numbers of technologies, if we listed them all, they'd probably be as large as the New York telephone book. There might be hundreds of thousands or even millions of individual technologies, perhaps all sorted into digital technologies, algorithmic technologies, movie-making technologies, whatever physics instruments, technologies, ones used in astronomy and so on. If you take all of those technologies, you begin to then get a view that novel technologies are constructed by using certain individual elements of that vast collection, and they add to the collection itself. So that would mean that the collection of technology over time creates itself out of itself. And that means, in turn, that technology is self-creating or autopoietic. Now, there's a lot of analogies. None of them are quite perfect. But I remember that the programming language Unix, this is quite a long time ago, back in the 60s and 70s when Unix was quite new, Unix had individual elementary components from which were created certain functions. We'd now call those library functions. Those functions could be put together to create yet further functions, which could be put together to create further functions, and so on. And this was all done in an open source kind of a way. Some of it was done at Berkeley. Some of it was done elsewhere. But notice it was a collection of objects that were put together for new purposes, and the new purposed objects were available for yet further combination, and Unix grew in that way. So too today does synthetic biology, or if you like, I'm looking at all of technology as what I would call a synthetic chemistry. The individual elements might have been what we had at the start, and then those start to get combined, and we have very simple molecules, some combinations of that alphabet or periodic table then get further combined, and so the whole thing grows out of itself. I want to elaborate that in a number of different directions. If that's true, then I would also have to add that if that's true, then all modern technologies would be constructed out of primitive elements that, say, existed 10,000 years ago. Bow drills and elementary pottery firing techniques and fire itself. And we know that isn't true. So I have to modify this and say that every so often novel technologies are created by capturing phenomena such as happens, say, with nuclear magnetic resonance being captured and used in MRI machines, magnetic resonance imaging machines, say, in hospitals to do diagnostic work. But notice the capturing itself always uses existing technologies. So again, what I'm saying here is that one way or the other, the elements that exist at any time for technology form a substrate or a collection that's available to create further technologies. Sometimes they do it by capturing fresh phenomena. Other times they do it by just putting together pieces for yet some new purpose. So you could think of technology, I like to think of the collection of technology as a vast network. Each node in the network, and there might be millions of such nodes, is an individual technology. The links for any technology go back to its immediate parent technologies, the ones that made it possible or became components in that new technology. And then that node, that new individual technology, becomes available to create yet further technologies. So in this sense, technology is autopoietic or self-producing or self-making. And it means that this vast collection of technologies is building out or building itself out of itself, albeit with the help of human designers, scientists, engineers, and people who put together these technologies. In that sense, technology is sort of alive, the way a coral reef is alive, but a coral reef doesn't grow unless there are individual polyps or organisms that do the growing. Autopoiesis is important for several reasons. I list them in my book, but one of them is that it shows that every individual technology has an ancestry back to the start in a pyramid of technologies that made it possible, technologies in turn that made those possible, and so on, back to very primitive ones. It shows that history is important. If technologies were put together from different elements in different ways at different times, we would have got quite a different history of technology. And it gives me a kind of a way to talk about it. In my book, I want to read you, if you don't mind, a page where I give a kind of genesis account of the build-out of technology. Things are quite abstract, and I wanted to at least spend a page making it concrete. So here's the way I believe technology builds out. In the beginning, the first phenomena to be harnessed were available directly in nature. Certain materials flake when chipped, whence bladed tools from flint or obsidian. Heavy objects crush materials when pounded against hard surfaces, whence the grinding of herbs and seeds. Flexible materials when bent store energy, whence bows from deer's antlers or saplings. These phenomena lying on the floor of nature, as it were, make possible primitive tools and techniques. Now, I'm thinking of 20, 30,000 years ago. Fire made possible, and these in turn made possible yet others. Fire made possible cooking, the hollowing out of logs for primitive canoes, the firing of pottery. And it opened up other phenomena that certain ores yield formable metals under high heat, whence weapons, chisels, hoes and nails, combinations of elements began to occur. Thongs or cords of braided fibers were used to haft metal to wood for axes. Clusters of technology and crafts of practice, dyeing, potting, weaving, mining, metalsmithing, boat building began to emerge. Wind and water energy were harnessed for power, combinations of levers, pulleys, cranks, ropes, and toothed gears appeared, early machines. And these were used for milling grains, for irrigation, construction, and timekeeping. Crafts of practice grew around these technologies. Some benefited from experimentation and yielded crude understandings of phenomena and their uses. So up to around 1300, 1400, 1500, in time, these understandings gave way to close observation of phenomena, and the use of these became systematized. Here the modern era begins as the method of science. The chemical, optical, thermodynamic, and electrical phenomena began to be understood and captured using instruments, the thermometer, calorimeter, torsion balance, constructed for precise observation. The large domains of technology came online: heat engines, industrial chemistry, electricity, electronics, and with these, still finer phenomena were captured: X-radiation, radio wave transmission, coherent light, and with laser optics, radio transmission, and logic circuit elements in a vast array of different combinations, modern telecommunications and computation were born. In this way, the few became many, and the many became specialized, and the specialized uncovered still further phenomena and made possible the finer and finer use of nature's principles. So this is really the evolution of technology. I want to finish here by showing you some steps by which this evolution takes place. I could just simply wave my hands and say, the vast collection of technology evolves. Now, I'm thinking of evolution and saying that everything relates back to something else, parent-wise. The vast evolution, or the collective of technology, evolves by creating new components from what already exists, from which yet further new technologies. But there's more to the story than that, and I want to just finish by showing you some steps in this evolution. So when a novel element forms as a combination, or comes about as a combination from existing elements, it's accepted, meaning it's viable, if it provides some needed functionality, and if the other technologies that form the economy declare to be economically viable, meaning it's better than what's out there. That novel element, in another step, starts to replace technologies and components with similar functionality across the collective of technology. Think of the transistor, say, years 1950, primitive transistors come along. They're accepted if they provide a needed functionality, solid-state amplifiers, for example. They began to replace existing technologies, vacuum tube technology. They add to the substrate of elements to construct from. The new element generates new needs. Once you have transistor technology, you generate a need for being able to refine silicon, dope silicon, work with silicon. And I won't go into that. That's another long story. And the new element may destroy certain technologies' niches for their dependent technologies. When automobiles came along, that pretty much wiped out horse transportation. When horse transportation came along, that in turn wiped out blacksmithing as a widespread industry. When blacksmithing disappeared, that wiped out the anvil industry. And you can go backwards. Each new element then destroys replaced technologies, niches for their dependent technologies, and then the economy, prices, costs, and so on, all readjust to those steps. So what I'm showing is, or the story I'm giving, is that there is a theory of evolution for technology. It is every bit as complicated as the Darwinian theory in biology, but it works somewhat differently. The technological evolution, this is on the bottom, is combinatory. Nobody uses the word combinatory anymore in English, so I had to revert to combinatorial. People talk about recombination, which I hate. I prefer to think about combination. But the evolution of technology is by combining things that are already out there. It can be quite abrupt, and it can lead to radically different things. It builds itself out of itself. And there's a lot of Darwinian-type evolution, meaning variation and shaking out of what doesn't work once novel technologies exist. So once we get the jet engine, there's a lot of shakeout, Darwin style, of not so good versions of the jet engine. Biology, in Darwin's account at least, proceeds in a very cumulative, incremental way. So if you're wondering how finches start to diverge into two species, Darwin has to tell a story about build-up of small changes, building up to the degree, adapting, say, to slightly different conditions and building up to the degree where they can't interbreed any longer. But, of course, in biology, there are occasional combinations that happen. Somehow, bacterial types of cells became organelles within eukaryotic cells. The eukaryotic cell was almost like a technology. It was a design that combined a lot of things that were out there. Of course, that had to happen Darwin style by tiny, small changes. Similarly, multicellular organisms, they're more like technologies. They are combinations of things that already exist. and those components start to themselves come together and interrelate in a very fine and fine-tuned way. Similarly, genetic regulatory networks, sometimes you get two regulatory networks that trigger each other and suddenly you have a combination. So combinatorial evolution does exist in biology, but it's rare. It happens maybe every few million years or a few hundred million years, and when it does happen, it changes the game entirely. Similarly, Darwinian evolution isn't absent in technology. It's going on all the time, but it's going on at a low level. Very broadly speaking, Darwinian evolution in biology is about incremental change that branches off after a while. Combinatorial evolution in technology is about combining things and abruptly finding quite new structures that bring you down a very different path and then lead to further combinations that will give you still further combinations. And that's why, by the way, technological evolution is so much faster than biological evolution. Well, this is a good place to stop. I think I went over my 20 minutes. I apologize, but I'll stop here. Thank you.
Well, that was marvelous, Ryan. Thank you very much. We have a good group here, and I'm sure it's just bursting with questions. So we'll turn to Francis for a few comments, and perhaps we can entertain some conversation among us for a few minutes, and then in about 15 minutes or so, 15 or 20 minutes, we'll take some questions and comments from the audience. Francis?
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. And I have to confess to having had a wonderful, stimulating lunch yesterday with Brian, where we talked a bit about the book and about how it relates to what I'm doing. So this is kind of a riff off that conversation. One of the things that he said to me that really lingered was that his hope for the book was that, you know, he carefully worked through this sort of architecture and this logic. He kept seeing highways that would open up that he had to restrain himself from galloping down. And he rather hoped that, you know, other people would gallop down them. And he confessed to me that the galloping and the horseback language came from his work with Cormac McCarthy, who's a dear friend and a writing mentor of his. And so the conversation was peppered with Western analogies, which actually sort of stayed with me. I came across this book about a year ago, found it very exciting because it relates so closely to my interest in social innovation and in trying to understand, you know, how individuals, groups of individuals, et cetera, work to make real change in intractable problem domains, homelessness, poverty, et cetera, and trying to understand what not only is the nature of the invention process, the coming up with the good ideas, but for our point of view, more importantly, how those come to have a very broad impact, to be almost part of the water supply, because how do they come to affect the system that, in a sense, the institutional system that created the problem in the first place? So it you know, has a dimension of the thing, the quote-unquote thing itself, and then, you know, its larger impact. And when I read Brian's book, it was a lovely experience of both the familiar and the surprising that you always associate with real learning. And there were three things that for me really resonated. You know, the first was the actual notion of technology as being a means to an end, a purposeful way to achieve certain kinds of goals. And resonated when I was a graduate student studying the work of Max Weber. He talked about technology that way as simply a way in which actors put together elements in sequence in order to achieve certain kinds of ends. There's a nice bridge there between what we think of as technical innovation and what we think of as social innovation. It removes the word from simply dealing with things to dealing with processes and interactions, basically over all kinds of design. So You know, I was happy to have that bridge because in the whole debate about social innovation, there's partly the notion, you know, is this just, are we just coming up with new technologies to solve the problems, or is it something else? And here, I don't have to make that distinction anymore. And in actual fact, most successful social innovations have a what we consider physical technical element as well as broad social elements. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, again, it took me back to Max Weber, was the notion that Brian really develops of what Weber called elective affinity, the way in which, you know, this all innovation is a combination of a new combination of old elements. And so the radicalness of that lies not in the elements, but in their relationship to each other. And this was a really aha moment for me, because when you start to talk to people about social innovation, what you find is it's very hard to find an it. And what Brian was saying in his book is that that's true with technical and physical innovation as well, that in fact what we have here is a combination of a number of different elements, and it's how they're brought together that matters, and whether, because I'm quite interested in the more radical ones that offer system change, whether those form a challenge. So are they like a new app that can just be docked into an existing system, or what Henry Mintzberg used to call the egg McMuffin type of innovation, or are they actually something that demands change and adjustment, as we just saw in one of his slides, around it. And so that was a very useful way to talk about whether something was, an invention was radical or it wasn't radical. And the third, of course, was, you know, the lovely organic, messy vitality that he talks about in technical innovation. Because, interesting, a lot of the work in social innovation is an effort to make it look less messy and less vital, and to try to bring it down to sort of a set of recipes that you might be able to use in a marketing or a business strategy class. But our experience of it is that it's sublimely messy. And that the people who are involved in it feel that they're caught up often in processes that are outside of their control. So there's agency there, there's human intent, as Brian talked about, but it would be difficult to call it deliberate in any real sense of the word. It's the kind of a participation in some processes that seem bigger than intent can imply. So that brings me to, you know, the two highways that it started me galloping down. And the first one was this concept of phenomena, because it's really, you know, interesting and exciting and familiar, I'm sure, to all of you to talk about, you know, physical, organic phenomena. But what does it mean to talk about social phenomena in that same kind of way? Are there underlying essences of human nature that you could talk about as a phenomena in that way? So you might talk about individually, you know, we're talking about altruism, are we talking about ingenuity, you know, we're talking about individual resilience, you know, what about desire or sorrow or joy? Do these become actually phenomena that can be built into, that undergird and a purposeful intent that might be social innovation? Or could we talking more about group kinds of phenomena that people like my colleague Mark Weber works on in terms of group psychology? Are there, you know, collaboration, competition, mutual influence? Can we trust social capital? Are these phenomena? And I began to sort of sort madly back through all the social science I knew to say, could we start to distinguish this? And I think, you know, Durkheim, Emil Durkheim, one of the earliest sociologists, used the notion of social fact, something that you can't observe directly, but you can observe its consequences. And it's interesting to start to delve back into that. So that was the first avenue it started me galloping down. The second one was the notion that to go to scale, as I say, most of the literature trying to turn that into recipe sort of treats the notion that some social entrepreneur has a good idea, and then going to scale just means doing more of it, producing more widgets, just means selling more, and there's a lot of problems with that in a kind of social market. But Brian's notion about this messy vitality, about the way these things produce themselves in autopoiesis, it made me suddenly think, well, maybe that's not what it is at all. Maybe it is this exact process of a number of new elements brought into combination, having kind of a stickiness or attractive quality, and other adjacent areas begin to adjust to them. And so individually, incrementally, new arrangements are made till suddenly you find that you have a sea change. It's also possible that you have a more deliberate kind of institutional entrepreneurship effort to place an innovation, to have it more impact. But certainly this is a continuum, and some of the things that have represented real changes in the past probably have this kind of messy, vital, incremental quality that make the people who are involved very unsure about what their role was in the first place. And it makes me think of one of Brian's compatriots, Seamus Heaney's poem about hope and history, where he talks about this notion of a sea change and hope for a sea change on the far side of revenge, you know, believe in miracles and healing wells. The notion that in this messy vitality, there are these resilient properties that actually have this healing quality, that without anyone's deliberate intent, there can be a kind of a welling up of new ways to do things with their own momentum. Well, you know, going back to McCarthy's metaphors again, for me that feels like galloping towards grace. So I really like that. Don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but thanks very much, Brian.
Wonderful. Thank you. Lee.
Thank you. And let me also give a welcome to everybody from Perimeter Institute, and also a thank you to our wonderful staff who have let us do this here and organized it so well. There are so many points to start off a discussion with Brian, and Francis led into some of them, and I'm going to just start to riff in the hope that I don't gallop away, and Brian will interrupt me, and then we'll be into a conversation. Where I want to get to, but I'm not going to start there, is the relationship between technology and science, which I think we should discuss. But I want to step back, because the notion or the definition that what technology is to capture phenomenon or orchestrate or program natural phenomena or social phenomenon for human purposes seems to me to be more than a definition of technology. It's a characterization of what the human species does. And you talk about the analogy and the disanalogy to biology, but what you suggest but you don't say, so let me riff on it, is really that the process, what human beings are, what the human species has done, is learn to deal purposefully with and externalize what organs of animals do. That is, our organs are things that capture phenomenon to a purpose, and what we, the human species, are is that species which has learned to do that for ourselves and not wait for biological evolution to do that. So you gave the beautiful Genesis story, but also in that story is just agriculture, domestication, clothes, music, art, all the things that human beings invent are fit under your definition of technology, and so I think you have a theory not just of technology in the sense of microprocessors and BlackBerries and transistors, but a characterization of what we are all about here. And I'll stop there, and then if you give me another chance, I'll talk about how to fit science into this.
I have just one comment on what Francis said, and that was that Seamus Heaney was also a friend of mine, a drinking companion. When I was a grad student in Berkeley, Heaney was visiting, and we knew from Ireland, we had mutual friends, so we used to go out drinking together. I went to Queen's University, not in Kingston, but in Belfast, and Seamus Heaney had gone to Queen's as well. And I don't know if you've followed him at all. He's a wonderful poet, since got the Nobel Prize for Literature. But what Heaney told me was, he said, I haven't got a PhD. He said, so they won't let me teach at Queen's in Belfast. And I said, well, that's too bad. Yeah, he said, so I just have to put up with teaching at Harvard and Berkeley these days. Anyway, I have great memories of that. The other thing is what Lee is saying, and that is that as human beings, we have learned to express externally, by external means, what other organisms have had to do internally. So if other organisms wanted to fly through the air, internally they had to generate wings and find some means, some Darwinian means to do that internally, whereas the difference with us humans is that we have managed to capture external phenomena and thereby speed a lot of this up and do the same thing externally and do a lot of things other organisms, other animals can't do. All I can say is, Lee, this is absolutely on target, and I wish I had thought of it and put it in the book, but I didn't. And it's a rather beautiful set of thoughts.
So let me push you on an implication, and I'll turn this back over, but give me another minute or two to riff. One of the things you touch on at some point is time.
Yeah.
And time is something that we here at Perimeter Institute are deeply interested in, is the nature of time. And indeed, you talk about something which is a central notion in physics of general relativity, which is time being relational, only there not being an absolute time, but occurring, being time being an aspect of relationships that change, or causal change or other kinds of change. But there is, and in that sense you're very with contemporary physics, but there's an aspect of your description and also Francis's, your description of which you're so comfortable with, which completely clashes with the philosophical framework of natural philosophy or physics as it stands now. And I want to confront you with this, which is that you have the continual invention of the novel.
Yeah.
And that's also what you're talking about, Francis. Processes by which novelty is invented continually, and novelty comes to play a role to dominate over and over again. But we physicists live conceptually in a world in which novelty is not possible, because all the world is a bunch of elementary particles, and they satisfy some laws which some of us like to think about as timeless or just being true.
Yeah.
And the laws take initial conditions and evolve them, whether it's quantum mechanics or classical mechanics, deterministically into states at later time. And any property of the world at a later time in this philosophy is just some function, and a mathematical function that you can find by solving the equations of motion of the initial conditions. So strictly speaking, novelty is impossible.
Right.
Within the framework, that is, all that there can be is motion, and motion is just moving around to the particles that already exist. So this is something I've been troubled with, and you, there's a wimpy way to get out of it and just say there are different domains, and you in the social and you in the technological world live in a domain that is distinct and has a distinct philosophical orientation or framework than physics. But if we want to unify our domains to bring everything into one world, what do you think? I mean, is this a problem?
I don't see it as a problem, but I'm kind of awed by this audience and by talking the philosophy, deep philosophy of physics. So let me blunder ahead and say that in the same way that you're talking about all things, if you work from elementary particles and work forward, then all the future is contained in what is there already. That, for me, is a very Laplacian approach to science. But I could equally say that all possible combinations that we have seen are possibly predetermined or at least implicit in what was there, say, 10,000 years ago. Basically, I'm saying we have captured families of phenomena. We don't even know if there are further families of phenomena that are still out there to be captured. And we are working our way or finding our way into what looks inherently novel. But if you say those phenomena already exist, and the possibility of capturing them and using them therefore exists by capturing a more elementary phenomena, then all that's implicit, at least in the, as the possibilities from 10,000 years ago or from now. So it's not different. I hope I'm not being too unclear about this. It's not different from physics. It's all physical after all. And I don't want to rule out the possibility of spiritual anything. I'm just saying that let's say it's all physical. The other thing I would point out, though, is that we live in a world, and what I meant of time being relational is if you take what Tad pointed out early on, that technology is what determines the time we live in. So if I wanted to say, let's go back to the 1500s, it wouldn't be like the Renaissance weekend or something, we put on other clothes. To really get back to the 1500s, we would have to wipe out all technologies that we've discovered since then. If you start to think that way, you begin to realize that this set of technologies that are extant at any moment, 1543, determine those times. Say, well, ideas do as well, human behavior, battles and kings, but more than anything else, it's the technologies. And time becomes very relational, meaning that it's not so much that time is defining, that absolute time is defining the unfolding of technologies. Of course, it does from one point of view. But if you start to say that technology creates the times, the era we live in, then as technology develops and as technology speeds up in its developing, which it has done over the last 200 years, it's creating faster and faster time. So it's creating change faster. And in that sense, technology is creating the era upon era that we're going through. I'm old enough to have lived through a lot of technological change, and it's a very different era from where I grew up in the 1950s. Very, very different. So in that sense, time is created by the technologies.
Lee, do you want to come back on that immediately, on this issue of novelty? Because I know Francis would like to say something, but this is obviously a...
Well, I'm not complacent about this. I think that there... I think that there is room to give on the physics side, and I think that this is really a topic for another discussion. But there are issues in physics like what chooses the initial conditions and what chooses the laws, that that as long as we keep the philosophy of physics that I described, seem insolvable. And for example, Charles Sanders Peirce a long time ago suggested that they would only be solvable under a notion where the laws of physics could evolve. And that raises the very troubling issue of whether there could be novelty all the way down.
Right. Well, I think we'll leave that one aside for a moment, the idea of novelty all the way down. Some people might find that profoundly threatening. I think probably a lot of us find it perhaps very emancipatory, but we'll leave that for a time. And Francis, do you want to make some immediate comment?
Yeah, just, for me it seems that the notion that at the very basic level novelty isn't possible doesn't mean that there aren't so many recombinations and combinations of elements that from the point of view of human experience, novelty seems to be being generated. Do those things mutually exclusive?
Yeah, if you take all the beads in the kaleidoscope and... In theory, or at least conceptually, every possible pattern is there already. But as you turn the kaleidoscope, at least you have a sense that new patterns are always being created.
fine. And then I'm going to say something, and then I think we should bring in the audience. Okay.
And just, relating to that as well and the notion of time, I mean, one of the questions around phenomena, I mean, Brian talks about, physical phenomena being continuously identified or discovered. I'm not sure whether the same could hold true for what I was thinking of as human phenomena. And yet, when you think about the issue of time, we certainly know we can forget certain human phenomena. So when you look at a history of something like a problem of relationship with Aboriginal cultures, you can go back, you know, even not that far, and look at something like residential schools that at the time were thought of as an innovation, as a social innovation, and which were based on what was perceived as certain kind of phenomena of emancipation, assimilation, which now, of course, have been, in a sense, forgotten, because other, you know, other values, in a sense, other aspects of human phenomena are considered to be much more important to emphasize. So things kind of appear and disappear like strands of a rope. Whether new things are totally discovered, I'm not sure is quite the right language. But certainly when you look back on a long-term case of any of these intractable problems, you see how every generation of solution is entirely dependent on the course of the first. So it is these evolving cycles which can only be explained by what went before. So I think it certainly shares that property.
I would say absolutely true. When textile machinery started to come along in the 1760s, 1770s in England, that led, and I won't go into the details, to over time by 1820, 1830, to the modern factory system with mills and all kinds of factory workers producing textiles and other manufactured objects. And what was needed for that were to facilitate that and make it work were a number of social innovations. And it's up to you to say, you know, whether those already implicitly existed or were new. One of them was a sense of clock time, that to make a factory system work, people had to arrive on time, they had to all work to a schedule, a whistle would blow, and people needed clocks, they needed watches, they needed a sense of time. They were wedded to their machines. Personally, I think Seamus Heaney style, I think this was a big step backwards, that we were all tied to clocks or Blackberries or whatever. Similarly, when all of that went over the top and workers started to be exploited in Dickensian conditions, then the social innovation of trade unions or labor unions started to come to the fore. You could say, well, those were always implicitly there in the Middle Ages, but new social innovations are brought in. I don't want to say society always lags technology, but you're absolutely right when you said that when novel technologies come along, they change the economic fabric, and then that causes social innovations to adjust and to come into being, maybe to go out of being again, and to come and go. So I see this as an enormous web that's woven, stretched, strands break, new patterns are made all the time. And in that sense, it's always novel. But if you take it that all possibilities are always there, there's nothing new under the sun as well.
That's another discussion.
Lee, do you mind if we move this in a slightly different direction? I don't want to seem hopelessly rude to the audience, but I actually have a little clock here. And I need to keep a little eye on the time because it's now 5:30. I think we'll go for another 15 or 20 minutes if that's all right with the audience. And before we open it up to the audience, I'd like to take this in a slightly different direction. One of the things I like about this community is that we can have these very philosophical and abstract conversations, but there is a rootedness in the pragmatic and in practical problems. And ultimately, we innovate for a purpose. Technology serves a purpose. And we have some phenomenal challenges that humankind is facing right now. We have to go through an energy transition, probably globally, very quickly. We have the climate change problem, widening gaps between the wealthy and the poor. Very clearly now, a critical food production problem globally. So I wonder what the practical implications are of your argument in terms of policy. If you were advising a government on how it should invest its research dollars, of what kind of research institutions it should create, what kind of science policy it should have, if you were advising a government on its educational policy, how does what you're saying change things? Where does it take us that's new compared to what we have right now in those areas?
Well, I live in Silicon Valley, and you know, I've been there for 30 years or so. And what I would say is that we're moving into an era, if I'm right, where all of these technologies, I have to use my hands, all changing very rapidly, call for very rapid configuration of responses. So you could say that every social response to a difficulty is, if that is a new combination of things, we need to be much swifter and faster about putting together responses. I would also say that every solution we have, if each technology is a solution, practically speaking, each solution brings along its own challenges or its own problems. For example, we thought we were doing very well with nuclear technologies, then that brings the problem of disposing of nuclear waste. Passenger aircraft technologies, and that brings along the problem of very rapid spread of epidemics if those occur, and so on. The internal combustion engine and the very industrial revolution have brought about global warming. So we need rapid response to that. I don't think that I have anything particularly radical to suggest, except that if technologies and responses are based upon phenomena, the people who understand phenomena, that is scientists, should be extremely well trained, and there should be plenty of them. I'm preaching to the choir here, but certainly we should invest in basic science. I don't see that happening in the U.S. Very much. Most of our, I wouldn't say most of our PhDs in science, but I think probably more than half PhDs in the U.S. in science and engineering are foreign, and including myself, by the way, foreign-born, yet with a U.S. PhD. And this is not a society that's investing as much as it ought to in science. It's not investing in thinking ahead. I would like to see more thinking ahead as to not just what solutions we have, but what problems those solutions will bring. If we're moving into an era, for example, of geoengineering to solve climate problems, then I think we need to have a very serious subject of thinking, what problems will that engender, and so on. Of course, there is a certain amount of that going on, but I think we need far more resources to think about.
It seems to me one implication of what you're suggesting, though, is important, very relevant to this community, and it's not one that you touched on. If what we want to do is sort of increase the rate that we can explore the combinatorial landscape of all possibilities, then we have to reduce as much friction as possible in the system that would impede combinations.
Right.
And disciplinary barriers, among other things, get in the way. And there are all kinds of institutional barriers in terms of funding mechanisms, publishing, and departmental structures, and all kinds of things that fundamentally impede the possibility of combining ideas or technologies across domains. And it seems to me that you seem to suggest that the greatest breakthroughs usually come from combinations that involve inter-domain combinations.
Oh, absolutely.
And we need to make that as possible as
I completely agree. I would just simply say very concisely that the old economy that I grew up in, Belfast was a manufacturing city, or you could take Manchester, or for that matter, Detroit. Those economies are about production, doing the same thing again and again and again, refining it, doing it better. The economy I live in, and I would also say the activities around Waterloo, are not about production, they're really about combination. Venture capital, where I live, is all about putting together things, putting together people and technology and practices and capital and legal advice and so on. And I think we're moving into an era of technology and the economy where we need to be far more agile, and it's basically an economy that I call generative. It's one of putting things together.
And unfortunately, a lot of our research institutions, our conventional ones and universities, just still don't really get it. They talk about interdisciplinarity, but it's a sort of an adjunct item on the list of things to do, not realizing that it really needs to be at the top. If this is the essence of innovation,
I completely
agree. Then it's a matter of survival.
Yeah, I think in the Santa Fe Institute, I was a professor there, still am, and people would ask me, professor of what? I'd say, I'm just a professor. We had no disciplines. And you could also say we had no discipline. The whole idea was to say we're not going to have disciplines. People may have been trained in physics or in computer science, but we were all thrown in together. And I think that we're heading towards that. And from what I've seen in 2 days here, there's a lot of that in Waterloo, as far as I can see.
Lee, before we go to the audience.
Just very quickly, when you talk about combinations and fostering recombination and combinations of things, that to me that immediately brings to mind that there are exponentially vast numbers of combinations. So it is not, just to not to give the wrong impression, you're not giving this impression, Brian, but just to emphasize, technology development, scientific development is not about randomly taking one of this and one of this and one of this and throwing them together. What plays the key role is judgment, experience, taste, imagination, risk. And therefore, we need to be comfortable in the scientific world, in the technological world. And again, in both Waterloo and Silicon Valley, these are not new, but they are threatening to the academic world, to be able to be comfortably in a world which is very risky, which is very playful
and messy,
and therefore where taste and judgment and imagination matter, and therefore therefore, we have to be wise, and we have to be, you know, a thing that that Brian is always in the background of Brian's book, and maybe this is a good point to stop on, is technology is to capture phenomenon for a human purpose, but the human purpose is the whole point.
Yeah.
And there's behind every page of Brian's book, there are human beings building things and making things and inventing things for a purpose.
I'd quickly comment on that and say that you could say that any poem is a combination of words in the English language, and that doesn't mean if you want to write poetry, you should throw words up in the air randomly and hope that they'll combine. If you look at, say, what someone like Keats is able to do with the English language, you see years and years and years of practice and imitation and finding combinations that work and combinations that are fresh. And then when the whole thing is finished, it's an utterance, an expression, it's a design. And it takes years to really become good at that, and that is what scientific and engineering training is all about. It's not different. It's absolutely not different. And the reason I mention in the book the reason that architects are lauded and musicians can play their combinations or compositions in Carnegie Hall, but miserable engineers are not looked at, is that their combinations are usually interior to some device, and only highly specialized people see them. Nobody knows that the quicksort algorithm, which was invented in 1960, is a wonderful, the elegant, simple combination worthy of John Keats or anybody else, in my opinion. The guy who invented it is now Sir Tony, I've forgotten his last name, but it's just as much a piece of poetry as anything else.
With that, I think we'll see if there are some questions or comments from the audience. I'm sure there are many, many. Let's start here.
Yes.
Well, we never really got back to that, but just to say it in two sentences, at some point in the book, Brian says, the audience and the reader will undoubtedly be reminded of Kuhn's theory of science. And just briefly, no. because Kuhn's theory of science is wrong, and I think is very unconvincing. And you have here, it seems to me, the germs of a better theory of science.
I didn't catch your question very well. I can't hear.
But, well.
Yes, sorry for, at the beginning, just Lee mentioned that he would address the technology as well as riffing on the science aspect of this, and that's what I had curious about, riffing on the science.
That's what I had to say. Yeah. That one point where I disagreed was the claim that there's a relationship to Kuhn, because I think Kuhn is very simple-minded and by this point is pretty discredited as a theory of how science works.
The structure of scientific revolutions, you mean?
Hmm?
You're talking about the structure of scientific revolutions?
Uh-huh. Yes, that's right. Yeah. He is. Yeah. But Lee, I've heard your argument. You might want to give us an elevator version of it on Kuhn.
Kuhn says that there is a structure for scientific revolutions that starts with the piling up of anomalies, and then at some point the anomalies get too bad and somebody takes them seriously and invents an alternative theory. And I'm really here with Feyerabend, who suggests, first of all, that there are always anomalies. And there are also always alternative theories, and science progresses faster by the competition between alternative theories, which generate ideas about crucial experiments, which then generate anomalies. That's just one of several things. But I think Brian has in his book the notion that a technology is a subclass of something called a purposeful system, which includes social systems like legal systems. And I think that just the germ of an idea of that is a starting point of an analysis of how science works. And why I think that is the emphasis on the ethical or the moral element of the purpose. Science exists for a purpose, and scientists are bound into communities by their common purpose.
My question just...
I think we should see, given the limited time, to see if there are other people. Is there anybody else? And you don't have to go to the microphone as long as you can project. Well, let's start here and then take the next person.
This is a question for Brian Arthur. I'd like to know how your thinking has changed about economics given this new understanding of technology. And I'd be particularly interested in hearing what you think of externalities in economics.
Oh, wow. thank you. My thinking's changed very deeply over 3 or 4 decades about economics. And I used to see economics as a Newtonian system. It was very much something that had been, that I was taught. Phil Murawski writes about economics being basically 19th century physics or thermodynamics projected into the 20th and 21st century. That's no surprise, some of the top economists, including Alfred Marshall, were trained as mathematical physicists. He was second wrangler to Lord Raleigh, and it disappointed him deeply that he didn't come top in Cambridge in physics, so he went into economics instead. And I don't know if it's to our detriment or not, but brought a lot of ideas with him. I want to mention one idea that's changed me very deeply, or at least a complete difference in thought for me. And again, this is yet another of Francis's avenues that I haven't traveled down. Maybe other people will. I was basically taught in Berkeley that, or anywhere else for that matter, I was taught that the economy is a container for its technologies. But I began to realize in writing this book that the economy isn't a container or a big machine, if you like, where technologies are slid in and out. You know, we have transportation by horse and coach. We slide that out, we slide in the railroads, we slide that out, we slide in airplanes and things. No, I don't see it that way anymore. I see the economy as a set of arrangements and actions by which we fulfill our needs. But those arrangements are all means to purposes. So the economy isn't a container for its technologies. The economy is an expression of its technologies. And there's a kind of subtle difference in thinking. That is, the economy comes out of its technologies, rather than seeing technologies coming out of the economy. Of course, there's a circular loop, and it's both. And it's a bit like saying that an ecosystem is a container for the species within it. But if you take the species out of an ecosystem, there's no more ecosystem. An ecosystem is created by the species and the environment they're in. So the economy is an expression of its technologies, and the economy therefore changes as these different arrangements, some of them are social, many of them are physical, some of them are algorithmic, scientific, and so on, and the economy keeps changing and reinventing itself. And Tad was asking me about practical importance. I have been asked again and again and again as an economist, and I'm sure several, if you're an economist, you could ask this all the time, is the United States over as an economy? Now, you're Canadian, and you might say, well, let's hope so. I don't know. But, all right. Let's just say, is North America finished and China is taking over? Well, no. Once you begin to see the economy as an expression of its technologies, you realize that that economy in North America and in Western Europe is welling up. And the source, like a volcanic system on the edge of tectonic plates, land is welling up. And what is welling up is new bodies of technology. And North America, if you think of those new bodies of technology, genetic technologies, proteomics, nanotech, photonics, etc., all coming out of modern science, all dominated by North America, every last one of them. And I don't see them welling up in China or India, not yet. So once you start to think about the economy as following from or being an expression of its technologies, there are practical implications. And that's changed my thought deeply.
Good. Tad had mentioned about some of the kind of global pressing challenges that we're facing right now. And a lot of people seem to put a great deal of faith in the capacity of technology to address those challenges. Are we running the risk at all right now with all the various externalities that, in fact, something could be happening where technology may not provide an answer quick enough anyways?
Well, it's the subject of one of Tad's books, which I think is a classic. You should answer that one, not me. I'll give you my very short answer is I don't know. And I think it could possibly be the case. We could have, to put it very coarsely, we could have screwed ourselves by now. I don't know. I really don't know. I hope, the Western hope is that we can always find yet more technologies to get us out of the predicament we're in. But we will find new technologies, and then we have to find solutions to the problems those bring. That seems to be never-ending. I just hope we don't fall behind. I'm curious what...
I can say something very quickly. I remember I was speaking in Ottawa with a fellow panelist at one point, and the question was, is our goose cooked? Is it too late? And surprisingly, my fellow panelist said yes. And I said, well, the systems that surround us and the systems that make us up are too complex for us to really know one way or the other. And as long as the world is full of unknown unknowns, which I think everybody here is sensitive to, there is room for hope, because there may be breakthrough or new pathways, breakthrough possibilities and new pathways that we haven't even conceived of yet. And I think that the audience found some satisfaction in that. I mean, pretty clearly our situation is grim, but we certainly don't know enough to say that that we're at the end of the road.
So you have a very definite answer here that we don't know.
Yes, we'll take, I think, one more, unless there's anybody else with pressing need to ask a question, but I think we'll finish at this point.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and there's so many different areas I'd like to approach, but I think I'd like to go back to the basic notion of what life is about, and what I learned many years ago, which is that organisms are basically entropy pumps. And we want to lower our entropy, and in order to do that, we we consume energy, we pump that, we pump out all that entropy so that we can organize our own information. And what we've done, you know, as humans, we've learned to organize fantastic amounts of information mm-hmm. in our minds, and we've learned how to externalize that as well. We create yeah. libraries, we communicate with each other, so we're organizing information. And with technology, it seems that we've learned how to externalize this. We create tools that allow us to continue doing this. And we keep, in this process, we keep consuming energy and other resources now. It's no longer just energy, but it's all of the resources on the planet, using the energy that comes to us from the sun. And when we think of that model, it does get depressing from the perspective of the model is we keep consuming energy in order to do this, to produce the technology that allows us to acquire and organize more information. And that seems to be the long-term trend of what we're doing. Does this model, you know, I guess, seem to fit with what you're looking at? And I want to try and toss one more thing in. Is you've got this notion of time and time progressing faster. And certainly from a technology perspective, it is. We're consuming energy more rapidly and expelling it out more rapidly. And yet the underlying physics has time constants that don't change the same. So the planet has these very long time constants in terms of, you know, how long it takes the carbon dioxide to be removed from the atmosphere and so on. Is this going to be a major barrier? And how do we approach that?
Well, if you look at it, say, from a long-term perspective, long-term, you would say something like in the whatever period we're in now, the modern period, and I'm thinking as a paleontological eras.
The Anthropocene.
The Anthropocene. Thank you. One species of primates managed to pull off an interesting trick. It's a trick that Lee alluded to. It's that we learn to use external phenomena for our own purposes. So if you're telling the history to somebody from another galaxy and what happened on Earth right now, you say one species actually learned this trick of orchestrating external phenomena for their own purposes. And we've done well by it. Our children don't die anymore, by and large, under age 5. And 100 years ago, they would have. We live long lives, we're relatively comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. What I object to in this is that in doing so, we've managed to convince ourselves that as human beings, we are sovereign on the earth, that it's all about us, all about human beings. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. And we've also got ourselves into a predicament, and this goes, you know, to whether there's, are we basically at the end of the line? Have we invented our way into extinction as a species? Maybe, but what I point out in my book is that we have a very peculiar relationship with technology and nature itself. If we ask what is the hope for ourselves as a species in the future, you know, how can we be better off? How can we solve our problems? How can we deal with global warming? What's the hope in the future? That hope is always in technology. But we are an animal species, and the deep trust we have and the grounding we have doesn't lie in modern technology. It lies in nature. And so we have this pull back and forth. If we want to do stem cell research, wonderful. But is that natural? If we want to fill the atmosphere with sulfuric whatever, that might get us out of our predicament, but how natural is that, and so on. So we have this massive collision at this point in time between our hopes in technology and our trust in nature. And I think I watch movie after movie after movie mm-hmm. that shows something that can happen. I'm thinking of the movie AI, or I'm thinking of Star Wars. what can happen in the future, and if some version of technology gone askew, like Frankenstein's monster. It's not new. This is Daedalus and Icarus. We can invent things. How natural is it? And we crash if we don't use this properly. So there is a moral of the story. I'd like to see a bit more humility. I don't think it's all about us. If other species go extinct because of our technologies, that is reprehensible, and there's no excuse for it. And yet, among the worst sinners, I'll finish with this, the worst sinners in this whole area are my fellow professionals, economists. We are capable of looking at wolves in Alaska and saying, what is the economic impact of whether they go extinct or not? How will that affect us as human beings? Well, how does it affect the bloody wolves? And if you ask wolves the same question, what do you think from the point of wolves, which human beings go extinct or not? They might have a very different point of view. So I'll leave you with that.
Very good. Last remarks, Francis.
This discussion has raised for me a really interesting, the opposite, the dark side of galloping towards grace, which is that, if there's a kind of tension between the notion of we need to respond quickly to these crises. You could almost argue that these big crises are sort of autopoietic as well and have their own momentum. And if it's true what you're saying, that there's this kind of self-organizing property around technology, it strikes me that it creates a kind of an inertia. Yeah. So no matter how quick and smart people are, if they're in fact somewhat constrained by the bodies of components and component technologies before, they can't necessarily leap into a response to, an emergent global phenomena problem. They may be thinking they are, but they're working within those constraints. And so, you see the development of things like nanotechnology, you think they're great, but you don't necessarily feel that there's any link between that and trying to solve a climate change problem. And, so it's... There is an inertia in the system, if you're right about the autopoiesis, that is a little worrying.
Oh, I completely agree, and I would say I love technology. I was trained as an engineer, and I'm absolutely fascinated by technology, and I love to figure out how things work and see all the components and see the scientific phenomena behind everything. I'm totally fascinated, and I think it's magical. The first page of my book, I talk about a particular technology where there is a macaque monkey, and it's in a lab, I think, in Chicago. I'm not sure of the university, but they've actually wired it up, and you may be quite cognizant of this, where it can move a mechanical arm to feed itself, but it moves it by thought alone. They can actually tap into the neural circuits in the brain and then amplify those and have those move some sort of an arm. I find that wonderful. I find it thrilling. I find it slightly menacing. But I find it absolutely amazing. And yet, I had to comment in the preface to my book, I said, people say he writes about technology, therefore he must be completely in favor of it. And this is all about technology and modern technology and how it operates and how it builds out. Therefore he's a big proponent of technology. So to completely counter that, I just put in a sentence at the end of the preface. I said, a doctor or an oncologist can write about cancer, but it doesn't mean they're particularly in favor of it. So I want to resolutely straddle the fence. And I think I will close with this. What we have invented as scientists, as technologists, as human beings, is absolutely magical. It's phenomenal. It's incredible. And yet, it's, as Francis says, it's now got its own momentum. It's, to quote French philosophers, it is a thing unto itself, and we cannot possibly stand in it, et cetera, et cetera. and it's beginning to run us, and I don't like it. I think I'd like to go back to wherever, the Arctic, and live without technology. But the one thought I want to leave you with is, as scientists and other social scientists, because it is so central to what's going to happen in the future, it is definitely worth thinking about. And I don't mean just innovation or this or that technology. The whole thing, where we're going with this thing, it is worth thinking about.
Lee, last words.
Brian, something that somebody told me as an author, which this reminds me of, is that a book that you write is a bridge, and very often the author is the last person who can cross the bridge. So let me tell you where I think your book takes us, which I think is not where you want to go, and challenge you. I think, as has come up in this last discussion, there is a fear of technology that comes from a belief that there is an absolute distinction between the natural and the artificial, or what nature is and what we are as natural beings and what we create through technology. Okay. And I think where your book takes us to is the disillusion of this distinction. And I think that this is the hope that I have for the future. I have no wisdom that anybody else has about whether we're going to resolve the current crises about the climate and energy and food and so forth. But I do have a sense that if we do resolve them, we will be conceptually in a very different world. And there's been very little thought given to not what are the consequences if we don't resolve them, which there's lots of movies and fiction about, but what are the consequences for human culture and society and for how we think of ourselves if we do resolve these problems. And I think, in a word, it is to the price of solving these problems will be to dissolve the distinction between the artificial and the natural. And I think your book will come to be seen as a key document that led the way to it. Well, so if that's frightening to you, I mean it to be.
Let me just say, you're across that bridge long before I am. But I agree with you, and I think it's very insightful. I must say, I'm very grateful to everyone here and in the audience. I think this is a subject worth thinking about.
Well, thank you all very much. I want to say that this has been a truly remarkable conversation, and Francis Lee and Ryan, and thank you to the audience. I'd also like to mention three people in particular who helped put this event together: Cassandra Perutz, the Wiki administrative assistant, Kirsten Robinson, who has been working with Wiki for quite some time, and Don Parker, the associate director of Wiki, who is just invaluable in trying to hold everything together. The Perimeter Institute, of course, for making this facility available. Thank you very much, Lee, for arranging that. And I'd like to say, before we close, and with one last thank you, that Brian's books are available outside if anybody would like to take a look at this remarkable book, which is just a wonderful read in addition to being a fascinating argument in itself. Thank you all again.
And I'll happily sign it, too.
and thank you for coming today. All the best. Thank you.